This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Roll back low wages, 9 stories of new labor organizing in the U.S.
Right now, if we were to select, if we were just to look at one word to best describe the most important current trend in the economy of the United States, precarity would be a leading candidate. America's middle class is shrinking, and recent polls suggest that possibilities for merit-based advancement are at their very lowest point ever. A growing number of people work low-wage jobs under precarious circumstances, often without long-term job security or health care or possibilities for advancement or retirement.
Many quite literally find themselves one sick day away from being fired and replaced by another person desperate to feed her or his family. Increasingly, precarity in our working lives or in those of our neighbors, our friends, or our loved ones has become the new norm. With inequality on the rise, the U.S. government largely beholden to corporate interests and austerity the economic recipe du jour, the implications are significant for the future of working people.
And we're going to talk about roll back low wages, 9 stories of new labor organizing in the United States with Sarah Jaffe, labor journalist and author of the new report, Roll Back Low Wages, and Albert Scherenberg, co-director of the Rosa Luxemburg Stiftung New York office. And hi to both of you.
Hello.
First of all, I said the word precarity. I'm not sure everybody understands why I might have chosen or why, in fact, you did, Albert Scherenberg, choose the word precarity to be the leading candidate to describe what is going on economically for workers across the globe, really.
Yeah, I think it's actually a very important term in terms of framing the whole debate, because precarity is a key word to describe this process. It means that workers are put under all kinds of precarious conditions, such as temporary work contracts with little benefits and protections, and of course, above all, with low or very low wages. And you pointed that out already. They are so low that you cannot sustain even yourself, not even to mention the family. The precariousness is something that on the one hand describes the low-wage sector and its precarious conditions, but at the same time, I think it's important to note that precarious work conditions actually are not confined to the low-wage workers, but that they fundamentally affect all workers. For lowering the standards for some workers has effects in all sectors. And the shrinking of the middle class that you mentioned serves then, you know, as a reminder of what can happen to you if you are not yet in the precarious sector. So it poses a negative image for the middle class and the lower middle class, which in turn keeps up a high level of self-discipline, of compliance with anything, basically, just to keep things going, to stay afloat. And that's why some scholars have not only talked about neoliberalism, but about disciplinary neoliberalism, or as our comrades from Syriza and Greece call it, austeritarianism. It's the combination of austerity, which is part of the process of increasing the precarious sector, and authoritarian in terms of how this is being implemented against the will of the majority.
And Sarah, let's flesh this out a little bit more for the United States, at least. Things have been getting worse, or at least have stagnated since the 70s, but it's gotten much worse since the last crisis. Can you talk about not only in general what's been happening, but how that affects different groups of workers, especially during the last 7-8 years?
Yeah, so what we've essentially seen is the brief period in American history where we had a set of laws that allowed workers to organize into unions relatively easily, that brought up, you know, created a fairly decent wage floor for not everybody in the economy, it's important to point out, but a large majority of certainly the people that most newspapers and media talk about as being ones that matter. That the New Deal period is basically over. So we're back to precarious conditions. Like you said, we're back to very low union densities, particularly in the private sector. We're back to low wages. We're back to at-will employment, which we never really lost unless you had a union contract. And so those conditions bring down work for everybody. So we're seeing the work of, you know, middle-class journalism school graduates like me beginning to look a lot more like the conditions of the guest workers or the domestic workers that I discuss in the report who were originally left out of those labor laws to begin with.
One of the things, just going back to the report, Roll Back Low Wages, 9 Stories of New Labor Organizing in the United States, there are different groups of workers. Some of the ones that Ken and I are particularly familiar with, it's gone from car washettos to laundry workers to, of course, the fast food industry. But we look at groups like the Taxi Workers Alliance, the Domestic Workers United, and I mentioned the Laundry Workers Center. They're not your traditional organizing processes, and they have begun to make enormous inroads and bring to the fore these interests and concerns of the working class, and they've done it as a class. They've done it across industry, and I wonder if you can flesh out some of those concerns which you so beautifully carve out in your report, and then, of course, Albert, your thoughts on it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think you make a really great point there when you say that these are being done as a class, right? These are fights that are not largely happening workplace by workplace. In some of these campaigns, these broad campaigns to sort of organize a sector, they have won union victory. So the car wash workers in Los Angeles and in New York have, in fact, unionized these, you know, incredibly hellish workplaces, which are mostly staffed by immigrants, which are very low wage, which are, they often tell them that they're tipped and they can actually pay them under minimum wage, and they have actually won union contracts. Others of these fights are really not looking for that at all, and they're actually organizing in a much different way. So when you look at the domestic workers' strategy, it has revolved around winning these domestic workers' Bill of Rights. New York was the first. Massachusetts has perhaps the strongest one that is just going into effect now. And we're seeing in most of these places a combination of public pressure campaigns, organizing within the workplace, in many cases direct action in the workplace, with legal strategy, right? Legal pressure, lawsuits about wage theft, lawsuits about unpaid overtime, things like that, lawsuits about sexual harassment, racial discrimination, things like that, that are also rampant in all of these low-wage workforces. I'm sure everybody is shocked to hear. And all of these together are used to then pressure basically an entire industry or an entire sector to come to the table to raise the wages, to make the working conditions better, and to give the workers some sense of power in the workplace.
I think, you know, it's very important, the question that you bring up, the question of class as it relates to precarious work. If you look at definitions of precarity, you would probably also find that the term for the social class that is working under these conditions is called the precariat. So there is actually this direct link between social class and the working conditions, which is very important, I think. On the other hand, it's also important to see, and I pointed that out already, that this is not a process or a development that's confined to workers of or the lower strata of society, but it is meant and it does affect all workers very much. If you take a look at how inequality, you know, has become the issue of our time more lately again, that's a telling story that's very useful to apply here also. Also that social mobility, upward mobility in the U.S. is at an all-time low. So I think it was the New York Times that wrote a couple of months ago, if you want the American dream, go to Finland. not that everything is good in Finland, but they have, you know, sort of a different set, especially in terms of education, but also in terms of organizing the labor market and everything, that is much more beneficial to lower class workers. And the American situation, the U.S.-American situation, is specific, not really so much in terms of what's happening. It's somewhat specific in terms of, you know, the radical approach that it has taken by the factions of capital who are actually driving forces behind this.
Sarah, we see this movement growing and getting more diverse, and we see that more, in the beginning it would be one group of workers, maybe the fast food workers we demonstrated, and the Walmart workers would demonstrate, or the car washers would demonstrate, but recently we've been seeing all of these groups coming together, especially last week, and we see it across the country and indeed across the world. Now, we haven't gotten the momentum yet to make real change, although we have made some changes, but what do you think has been accomplished with this, and where do you think it's going?
So I was in Seattle a few weeks ago, and I was talking to the workers who had actually won their $15 an hour raise. Now it's going into effect over a period of years. They just got their first raise to $11 an hour on April 1st. And so, yeah, I mean, that was Seattle was the first big city. Little suburb SeaTac next to it actually went to $15 an hour before Seattle. San Francisco went to $15 an hour. This last election also phased in over a period of years. We've seen other cities go not to 15, but to some other level that is, they're all getting to a point where it's much higher than what had been discussed before, which was, you know, 10 an hour discussed on a national level was this big shocking thing not that long ago. Now it sounds ludicrous. And so that the $15 an hour demand has quickly gone from being a sort of pie in the sky crazy thing to reality and to something that workers can win, at least in a city. The problem with that, of course, is we have not gotten anywhere in New York because it has to go through Andrew Cuomo. So there's still a lot of problems with that kind of strategy because different cities, different states, you cannot win something through a state legislature that is patently worker unfriendly. Some places where they've been able to succeed with winning wage increases, it's been by ballot initiative, which is, again, a thing that only some states and cities allow. And so we're seeing this process, you know, they're finding ways to win things in various places. And that's great. It's also going to take a lot of work to figure out how we're going to win it in places that don't allow you to put an issue on the ballot, that are going to continue to be dominated by, you know, either Republicans or, you know, very business-friendly Democrats like our own governor.
I think that's very important that you point what you point out, Sarah. And I think we need to shift the debate because actually I think we or the movement is already winning to a certain degree. In the first place, you know, to have the movement itself is already quite an accomplishment because, you know, everything in their working conditions is set up in a way that they don't organize, that they don't mobilize, that they cannot fight for their own interests. And they have, you know, put a crack in this edifice. And I think that is already by itself something that was not meant to be. Second thing is, you know, because of this movement, also because of Occupy Wall Street, but specifically also because of this movement, the issue of inequality is back on the agenda, and it's back up high. It's not just an issue like 10 others or something, but it's really, really big. I mean, if even Hillary Clinton has to address inequality, which it's telling, you know. It tells you how the national debate has shifted. And then in the thirdly, what Sarah already brought up, you know, in some cases, real reforms have already been enacted by different means, but, you know, they are taking place. So the real material conditions of workers are improved.
Well, you know, one of the things that I'm fascinated and so drew me to the content of your work, Sarah, was we are dealing with primarily immigrant workers. A lot of what you raise up are immigrant workers and workers of color. And interestingly enough, one of the things that was not fully evolving in the context of the consciousness of those people that I spoke to throughout the course of the day last week in the fight for 15, was the correlation between race and class, that certainly the lowest strata of the working class continues to be people of color, continues to be immigrants, and how those issues merge. And the stories that you bring to the fore are very much revolving around people who have a human rights stake and see, as Martin Luther King told us so many years ago, that perhaps the great battle of the 21st century is the struggle for human rights. You can't integrate a lunch counter if you haven't got a dime effectively to buy the hamburger. Sarah?
Yeah, I'm actually going to tell you a couple more travel stories because of this. I'm actually traveling because I'm working on a book on all of this stuff right now. I was just in Atlanta for the big fast food strike.
Oh, I was hoping you were going to mention that. Yeah.
Yeah, there were many, many workers there for whom the Black Lives Matter fights have been very important. There was a group actually from Charleston, South Carolina, where Walter Scott was just recently killed, who very poignantly made the case there. And not too long before that, I was actually in the St. Louis area. And there are quite a few, Show Me 15 is what they call it down there, the Show Me State, workers who have been very, very involved in the protests down there from the beginning. I spoke to one young man. His name is Rasheen Aldridge. He's actually on the Ferguson Commission that the governor put together. And he's a young low-wage worker. He's 21 years old, I think, who has been really involved with the protest since the beginning, told me explicitly he and one of his friends from the campaign went down there right away saying, you know, we've got these skills from organizing on this campaign. We want to help bring that to bear here. And also making the explicit connection. I mean, in Ferguson particularly, I think it's been very easy to make the connection between the exploitation of workers and the conditions that create particularly black poverty and the policing, because the way that racist policing happened in Ferguson was basically to extract money from people. So you would get pulled over, you would get a ticket. This was very explicitly part of how the city was funded. And so it gave people there a really, really great race and class analysis of what was being done to them. It's very easy to understand your economic exploitation as part of racist violence being enacted on you by the state.
Albert, I'm interested in your thoughts, and I'm sad to say that the clock is racing us to the finish line here. So perhaps both of you, another minute apiece as to some of your thoughts, your conclusions. And, of course, you've got to let people know where they can get rollback low wages. Albert, and then I guess we'll give Sarah the last word.
Yeah, that's a wonderful idea. I think what is important for our office, but also more generally, is to focus on this sector and to support these struggles by the means that are, you know, on our at our disposal. For instance, I'll just give you one or two examples. The coming together of the class, race, and gender issue is something that's not just happening automatically. We have to work on it. For instance, we do organize tri-national labor meetings with trade unionists from Canada, the United States, and Mexico annually, and we last year brought them together with immigrant rights groups. And that's fascinating discussion because these more traditional unions, you know, they don't do that by themselves. But this is the kind of conversations that we need. Another one, I can't drop too many, is that we are analyzing right now the Walmart supply chains in South Asia in order to find out, you know, how we can use that knowledge in terms of supporting our Walmart and others.
So we're going to give the last 30 seconds to Sarah Jaffe.
You know, I think this is incredibly important, as we said, because this affects everyone. This is not just something that's happening to these workers over here in this one particular sector. This is spreading. This is happening everywhere. The things that happen to the workers who are locked out of labor law, who are the most excluded and the most exploited, are the conditions that are going to trickle up to the rest of us a lot faster than the money is going to trickle down to us from the billionaires.
Very quickly, how do they get the report? What's the website?
You can download it from rosalux-nyc.org. It's available for free download.
Great.
You're both wonderful, and we will continue this effort, both the organizing and the success, and we will go out reveling in the wonderful, wonderful demonstration of last week, the fight for 15 and a union that really unfolded around the world. We've been speaking with Sarah Jaffe, labor journalist, author of Roll Back Low Wages, and Albert Scherenberg, co-director of the Rosa Luxemburg, how I love saying that, Schufthung, New York office. Thank you.
I'm Jeremiah Olomo, and I work for McDonald's. I'm a crew trainer, and I went on strike today with Show Me 15.
My name is Jasmine Halsey. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, and I work at South Broadway McDonald's.
Hi, my name is Landry Ford. I'm currently from St. Louis, Missouri. I'm hired at McDonald's in St. Louis, Missouri on Natural Bridge and Kings Highway.
I am Tina Blackman, and I work at Hotel Lumineer, and I'm a housekeeper.
My name is Eleanor Taylor, and I work for Agape Home Healthcare.
Hi, my name is Dennis Love. I work at Kings Highway and Natural Bridge at the McDonald's, and I'm from St. Louis.
Walkout strike, you know, for Show Me 15. It's a low wage, minimum wage campaign. It's going around 160 cities around the United States of America now.
You got little housekeepers, you got restaurants. They're just showing that we all are united and trying to do something good for all of us.
We're basically working hard for something that we want. Instead of just talking about it, we actually being about it.
I was a little on the shaky side still. I wasn't really sure. I was like, oh my God. I had people around me, you know, they're protesting. And I was like, what's going on? But then after I got the feel of it, you know, I was like, okay, this is a protest, this is real.
I only make almost $200 every 2 weeks. That is not going to pay my bills.
I need this to happen because financially, with providing for my mother, I've had to give up my place. My motor went out in my car. I couldn't even afford to get it fixed.
It's not fair that I provide health care but get no access.
And I feel like $15 will give me a roof over my head, food on the table, and just to be out here living good and okay instead of trying to make sure I have food on the table, make sure my lights stay on, my gas stay on.
Adjunct professors are paid very low wages. We get zero job security and no benefits.
Here in Missouri, the Show Me State, more than 25% of the adjunct faculty is actually living at or below poverty.
I know other adjuncts who are trying to support their families under these conditions. They're trying to feed their children and pay their rent and their car payment and all that stuff, and at the end of the month, they don't have enough money to pay their utility bills. They get their electricity cut off every other month. It's ridiculous. It's not right.
I say, these multi-billion-dollar companies got us stuck living in poverty. Probably the owner of McDonald's hella mad at me, but honestly, I'm gonna keep protesting till they honor me. We don't want no trophy or no badge, we want currency. Put your signs up. Wendy's ain't paying enough. 10-10, cool, but 15 to pay my bills up. The struggle real, ain't none of these stories made up. If you got a voice and tell your boss they need to pay up. It's modern day slavery without the whips and chains. Dodging doping games, but we got hope and change. See, I'm a father to one beautiful daughter. That makes me go harder. How you gonna lock us in the zoo when there's no cage left? Got me working off the clock, I swear that's wage theft. But they don't know that there's a union protecting the workers. If you believe in your committee, then fight for your purpose. Show Me 15.
Show me what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy looks like.
Show me what democracy looks like.
This is what democracy looks like. It's not fair that I go to work 5 days out the week and I work hard from the time I'm there. McDonald's is me. McDonald's own me. And I do anything for McDonald's. And when I go home, then I can't pay my bills. And I've been at work 40 hours a week and it's still not enough. By me not being there, it really makes things not go like they're supposed to. And I know, but sometimes I hate that it has to be like that, but sometimes to make a change, you have to, you know, make a change happen. Just walking out, overcoming my fear. When I did it, it made me feel like I'm a better person. Now I feel stronger. It made me feel like I had power.
Going on strike, it made me feel as if it was basically a movement. You got to stand up for what you want.
Well, I have three children, and I want things to be a little better for them as well as my grandchildren. They're our future. And I want things to be better for them to where they don't have to work as hard as I did to get what they need.
Majority of these low-wage jobs are in our communities. It's been so amazing to see people step up and fight for their lives, because that's what they're fighting for. This isn't a game, and this isn't a joke. I mean, these are people's lives at stake. And they have said no more, and they've been stepping up.
We have to get together and unite. One voice is not heard, but when you get a whole bunch of voices, somebody will be heard. Even if you don't hear my voice, you may hear someone else's that's out here for the same cause.
Let's just do this. Let's make this movement work for all of us. Yay!
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.